Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Moore. This is reel 13, and it's still noisy.
You were saying that you had a standardised command structure, the same as the Army and the Navy, and that worked quite well. It was a natural
sort of. And then, of course, you had the command set with the radar and the whatever you need for execution of the jobs. And that covers both the air in its different phases, air defense, tactical air including interdiction and close support and all what goes into that according to the normal thing we were used to. We had on the operational side, of course, we had I'm talking now the fairly beginning after the war. We had quite an interesting discussion in the sense that we came home with the Spitfires and we came home with the Catalinas from the maritime side and the transport airplane that we had. But then, which was Dakota. But then, after a while, the business of getting new equipment and so on manifested itself. And of course, all Norway had to be rebuilt after the war. And I would say that I'd give that to the politicians, whatever their reason, that they weren't sort of downgrading the military in this. Maybe it was partly on bad conscience from before the war or whatever. But the business of re-erecting the defense they were giving their fair share, considering all the demands that was in the country as a whole. There were no complaints about that at all. But then came the question of what sort of airplane you should have. And in the beginning, we got some additional Spitfires. But then, obviously, that time was running out. And then the interesting part is, should you leave air defense as such and say that airplanes had their role? Or should you say that air defense in the traditional way of intercepts and so on was still an ongoing requirement? And we chose the latter. We said to ourselves air defense. So we got the Vampire. We bought the Vampire. We bought 50 Vampires at that time. Of course, they were good airplanes, a little short range, really, for our purposes. But you have to accept that. And as air defense, your short range is the same as with Spitfire, was a fairly short range airplane. So you say, so anyway, we got the thing. But it wasn't a clear go. Many of countries and so on said, I remember when SHAPE came into force and so on, many active, you can say, forward-looking people and so on said, oh, now air defense is out of on hitting the bases, you know, get on, take them on the ground and so on, that sort of thing, forget the air defense. You know. So we were kind of showing a certain amount of independent view in this, and gradually air defense became more and more, you can say, accepted as being something that most people would have to come back to a little. So we weren't quite a outdated on that.
Well, the strategy of preemptive attack is a rather risky one, isn't it? The idea that you can destroy the enemy's aircraft on the ground it involves getting the timing right.
Yeah, and also
it can go wrong.
Yeah, sure, you've got nothing left. And also you've got to recognize that ground defenses are getting, we lost more airplanes on ground defenses in the latter part of war than anything else.
Of course.
But then the Germans didn't have much to throw at against us in the air defense sense. So that discussion was pretty good. Anyway, we settled on that one. We also bought in some mosquitoes because we wanted to have something to be able to strike with. And also it was a question of reconnaissance and so on.
The mosquito had quite a good range, didn't it?
Yeah, they had a good range. Fine planes. But to come back to organization again, one thing was the equipment requirement, but also the organization. One interesting period was that hit us. When I was at Gardermoen, I was head of Gardermoen Air Station. That was the biggest air station we had. We had a Bosch. We had 120, 130 airplanes as it started. But when we got that, and the growth of the Air Force really took place with the mutual aid program, when we got in the 84 airplanes, fighter planes, and later the Sabre jets. And when that growth came, we got very dependent on American supply lines and so on, and their logistic system. We had to measure up to that logistic system. And one of the things that entailed was that we had to reorganize the station organization. That was a hard thing to fight with, because we were so used to the British system that to give away the close mechanics on actually the squadron area, where they were part of a relationship between not only to the airplane but to the pilot, and the pilot to the ground crew, and the whole that atmosphere that we just loved in your system was to be breaking up. We should have only the pilot of the squadron, little administration, a few technicians, more or less on a known basis from the central system on the base, and they should sort of give us the amount of flying hours to be used, and we should use them. So it was like a production line on an industry, you know. But the mental change to accept that as our system was, at least on a fellow like me, that was pretty hard. Strong fight. I lost the battle, I dare say, but then I was only one station commander. That was the head of the Air Force at that time, General Lambrecht, who really said that, well, if we go for these American airplanes, then we are tied up with their delivery things and the spare parts and our logistics and all that, and we got to go and do it full out. And there was no way to escape, really. But it was a tough time.
Well, it is a tough thing to do, to break up a winning team.
And we were so happy about the way we were used to it. You know. So, but there you are. That's the way it is.
You're mentioning that you had control centres, which I presume would be like the command posts that were established during the Second World War, with maps and information coming in. How was the liaison with the Army and the Navy carried on? Did they have liaison officers before?
Yes, they came in there. They had their separate sort of positions in that. And that, of course, is interesting because in our country, we that was another thing that happened even at the very last part of the war. That was the Navy and Army Air Forces joined, integrated. And this was supported by the Storting when we came home. And has been like that ever since. But we ran into, of course, some discussion about responsibility and areas of responsibilities, and jobs and tasks to be done by airplanes and ships and so on. What should be under Navy control? What should be under Air Force control? And how to operate all that? It's a difficult problem. It's a lot of things, and you are up against traditions, for one thing. They aren't always easy to just discard. And that worked really very fine. In fact, it worked. Now, you can say that during the war, we had been under the RAF umbrella. So we had two squadrons in the Coastal Command. And so we were used to this sort of thing. But even during the war, they were quite separately located. So we didn't see all that much to each other, but we were, and we had a joint headquarters in London. But when we came home, there was, of course, question about should the Navy still have some airplane or some particular type of airplane? Should they, for example, when helicopters came, should they come up to the Navy and be tied to the ships? And one has to remember that in the earlier days after the war, the concept of ship airplane relationship were something that were fairly close to each other. And so the thinking at home too was that you mustn't leave that. Whereas when you got airplanes higher capacity, like we did in the SA-16 Albatross, but even more when they arrived later, they are independent in their job. They go out, they seek, search, seek, and they can even sink. So they are autonomous. Is that what you call it?
Yes.
And then of course it's getting hard. You get the Navy would feel that you are being infringed upon in what is your area of responsibility. Suddenly you have an outsider, and it becomes absolutely necessary to find some sort of system where we could cooperate in a useful way. And we did that.
How was it done then? What was the system? Was it based on liaison?
Yes.
Representatives in your operations?
In effect, more than that. Although, yes, we joined in to the into the headquarters that we had established, say Bodø or at Stavanger and so on. And the Navy had their own man to be really in charge of. He wasn't the executive on the airplanes that were sent out, but he was the evaluating the requirements and so on. And he became a very strong man. In that system. So you can say that naval air were tied to the executive part within the Air Force, but you actually the use of it is combined as surveillance and so on, and cooperating with other forces, Navy forces, and so on, was done through Navy Channel in our headquarters. We call it the Maritime Ops, and it really has always worked real fine.
So were the Navy then tasking you for certain? Were the Navy tasking the Air Force for certain?
Yes. But then of course you can't task without consideration to the capabilities and the availabilities and all that sort of thing. So it needed that tremendous sort of sitting down together and saying, now, what is the best mean for this job? You know, you ship. Should it take that long time, or should you do that with the airplanes, sure reconnaissance and nothing more, or should they be left to do the job more complete, you know, that sort of thing. But it was a tentative area, and it really was a very strong reason why I decided when I had the Air Force, at a little later part of, because I got very involved in this, and it interested me too. I'm very inclined towards the Navy, to be honest. So I was very seeking, very strong, to give them a right place. Not just subdue them, but give them a proper place. And so to write our doctrines, the Air Force doctrine, where we outline, really, this cooperative play very much. And sort of put down really what should be for the Navy to do, and what should be for us to do, and how should we find the authority on the Navy side to deal with our thing. It came out really very good. One of the things I'm pretty happy about, actually. And I had many good friends in the Navy, and there was one strong fellow who really wanted all airplanes to be Navy planes.
Did he want a separate Naval Air Force?
Yeah, he wanted back to the old thing.
Old
so the only thing, it's the only way we can, and so on. And so in the discussion, I said to him that, well, couldn't we meet somewhere where, say, you have the navigator, the radio operator, part of the crew, that is, essential part of the cruise when it comes to system. finding the submarine, keeping things, reporting back, you know, all that, and so on. And he looked at me and said, "No, anyway, if you are responsible, I want it to be responsible so that I can really get at you if you don't fill your job." You know, but I thought that's a good way of looking at it. You know, so it didn't come up.
Did you have mixed crews eventually?
No, we didn't. No, we could carry a Navy man with us for certain purposes, identification of ships, for example, or something like that. But otherwise, we trained our people very much together. They became very much oriented towards Navy requirements and so on. So it worked out. I suppose Coastal Command works out fine within your system too.
Well, it's a similar sort of organisation where things overlap, don't they? What about your relations with the Army and coordination with them?
It wasn't without problem there too, especially when we got helicopters.
Yes.
And the Army thought, of course, that they should get the helicopters and so on, and they had strong reasons for it. But anyway, the parliamentary decision was that all these things that flew should be part of our business. And we went, they fought strong for getting their own helicopters. It was a little of the same. Now, I had a very good colleague in the Army side, CNC at that time, General Freeswald, and so on. And I remember when this discussion went pretty hot and so on, I said to him that you've got to follow the same idea as our Navy fellow I mentioned, that, you know, You behave and do your job, and if you don't do it, we'll get on you. You know, you take that position and so on. Of course, from the Air Force point of view, we wanted the people within the structure, and that goes for ground crews as well as the flying crews and so on, to be able to move, to have their growth and the system so they could take increasing command posts and so on. And one thing I disliked with the Army idea of helicopters wasn't that they couldn't fly them well. Sure they could. I mean, they are humans, like, it's a question of training. But what do you do with them? And what benefit do we get from them in the sense of our organization? It's, can they ever become a station commander? Can they become a squadron commander? Where do they belong when they are? So there are many of those, you can say, that relates down to career possibilities and how happy people will be, not only when they fly for a period of time and so on. How will you update them as time goes by? So anyway, it's gone on. But there are, of course, as aviation is taking bigger strolls into many activities that usually was only Army and so on, you get problems. Do you follow it up, and what does it cause? I remember one time I went to the Joint Chief of Staff meeting, and I said to my Chief of Staff that you know, sometimes I wonder, we had to reduce the mutual aid program was tapering out. You know, we had to reduce and so on. And I could get a lot of support from the Army for more helicopters. And there was no doubt that the Navy asked for more airplanes for Navy. But it was how to finance them was a different question. And it always came, you know, that you've got to cut down on the fighters or the missiles and whatever. You know, and that was very hard to live with. You know, so I remember I said to him at the time that I wonder, you know, when we come to this stage with the growth of aviation, broad spectrum, whether you shouldn't say to the Army that take the helicopter, but fund them yourself.
Yes.
And say to the Navy, you know, take the maritime and so on, but give up some things. And that sort of thing. I remember he looked at me and said, "You mustn't even think that way in the clear among them." But you know, you come to that sort of question. It's a question of financing.
Vision of the cake, the resources.
Yeah.
But I mean, when for the command with the army, was it the same kind of thing as with the navy? If you were thinking of close cooperation, coordination of operations, you mentioned how you got the navy really integrated into operations rooms. Did the army have a similar
representation? Yes, I was cheating, and my dear Priestwald, he knew I was cheating.
You were cheating.
In one thing, because when we wrote the doctrine, I was very set on having the endorsement by the Army and the Navy in the front page of the saying that this was accepted by the Navy and so on. And I got that. But I felt then, he almost said it, that you've got to keep in close support. You've got to, I mean, we train the people and so on, they've got to know that the airplanes will also do close support. Not only what you feel you ought to do, but close support that I knew and he knew that we just didn't have resources to it. And that come to the pitch, it looks fine on paper, and it was endorsed, but whether you would ever be able to fulfill it in a period of tension in the air anyway, hardly a situation of superiority in the air. Whether you could do effective ground support and so on. And if you start saying that you want to have ground support, it entails a lot of things. To train people up to be on the ground, to take you in, and do all the things that that effective ground support does.
Yes, you need forward air controllers, don't you?
And then if you have decided you should have that sort of thing, you've got to give them the training. It takes flying hours, and there you are.
You were also saying earlier on that in order to become effective in giving close air support to ground forces, the pilots really have to be not only well trained in that, but also experienced.
Yes.
It takes experience to develop the required accuracy.
Oh, yes.
Target acquisition.
Yeah, yeah. And be trusted by the people.
And be trusted by the people,
yeah. People down there. Yeah.
Did you find that as you were replacing propeller-driven aircraft with jets, the idea of close air support became less practical because of the sheer speed of the aircraft?
Not really, but the Vampire didn't lend itself so much to that. But when we got into the Thunderjets, of course, they were really a good close support airplane. But of course, speed is one thing, and you've got to find that target, you've got to identify it, you've got to have an angle of approach to it, and all that. So you need that control on the ground. Otherwise,
Well, I seem to remember that during the course of the war in Vietnam, the American air forces were returning to the use of propeller-driven aircraft.
Yeah.
Because simply because of the fact that they
were not
so fast,
yeah.
They had a better chance of actually spotting targets.
Yes. Of course, they developed on the jet side the so-called A-10,
yes.
which was a slower jet,
still a jet.
Yeah.
In the early days of jets, the whole point of it was to go faster, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Warthog, which I think is still operating.
It's not easy to make an airplane good to make everything.
What about the helicopters? And when the helicopters were first coming in, what sort of role was envisaged for them, because the early ones weren't really useful for fire support, were they?
They weren't. We had the Bell.
Yes.
K-47, was it? That was a good little thing, but it took only two people. And we had them placed more or less for close rescue. Around the airfields and so on. Then, of course, requirements came that they should do a little more rescue than that, than just our purposes and so on. And we fitted them. They had a hoist, of course, a fitted hoist on them. And then we had so you could lay people on the outside, on the actual boogie, on the helicopter, one on each side.
The
main idea was really to hoist down a thing, lift up the man, getting into shore, and leave him with some people. go out and do the same thing again. Oh. but it was that we got, and I found myself intrigued by helicopters. I went down to Riga and learned to fly them. And I'm very happy I did, because later when I had the accident investigation, we have had a lot of helicopters. And then you know why they flops like that and makes that sort of techniques involved. But anyway, the helicopter was a thing. Then we got the Bell, which was much more to the army use. And that is really when the question of employment and usage of the helicopters came up in force, because it had that capacity. It was a very, very good helicopter. It was the one that was so widely used in Vietnam. And then we had one thing that which I was very much myself involved in, because it interests me so much. That's always dangerous when you sit on these jobs that you get there. And that was the RC rescue.
Yes.
And so on. And we had that that Bell helicopter was quite capable, fitted hoist and so on. But then it was a question of could we do more? And the Danes got some Sikorsky helicopter for rescue service. We hadn't got that at that time, but the Danes did a formidable job in a specific disaster by a big ship down, fairly Norwegian ship, fairly close to Denmark. So it was in within their rescue area, but it was the Danes who did the job. We did the on-spot coordinating job with an albatross, and we did a good job, but the Danes actually did the job that hit all the papers and all that sort of thing.
They were lifting up.
Yeah, a formidable job. And I remember the defense minister, who was actually a fighter pilot during the war, a good one too, Tiedemann, he called me on the phone and said, Willem, he said, get us a rescue service. The parliament demands that Norwegians are being rescued by Norwegians. So I was very much set on making a rescue service, and I put a lot of personal effort in it too. And it became that. And then, of course, later we got the Sea King in as an equipment. That was after my time, and they have certainly done a good job, I must say. Now, there's been a lot of discussion, still going on a lot of discussion about the rescue service, because the Sea King, of course, moves towards its end. We're headed for 25 years
it's
now.
It's getting very old.
Yeah, 25 years or more. It can go another 6 or 8 or 7 yeah. years, but you've got to have another one. And there's a question of what sort of type and so on is going on.
When they decided they needed a rescue service, did they fund it? Were you giving them money to?
No, this was the thing. We should be the executive agent for the service with this seeking as it became.
Yes.
And but the it came under the Ministry of Justice. They should be you can see the anchor point for the rescue service, as they are responsible for other disasters and so on, in police and whatever it is. But the rescue service, the organization that we set up and so on, was centered really around the police authorities in the different areas, where we fitted in with them. And they have formed a sort of a rescue committee when it was required. Otherwise, we would be the main thing, right out of flying control, more or less, executive body. And then when the rescue group assembled under the head of the police in, say, Buda, at the tower, in the tower, they would sort of evaluate where to search for efforts and so on. And they would pay, too. So we get the money refund from the department there. And actually, they footed the bill for the planes themselves, too. So we cannot complain anything about that. And I think that the rescue people on 33 O Squadron, that was the old wartime squadron, when they left the Albatross and got helicopters in instead and so on, they have continued to do that job. And they've done a very, very fine job, very respected by communities in the close area and so on. So I hope we will behave in a way.